This is Talmud Shiur, Talmud class on April 6, 2016. We are beginning back in the Gemara, Gittin, page Lamed Chet Bet, and continuing the look at Avdut, slavery in the big as it's presented in Gittin, in terms of the freeing of slaves and the whole, what I want to call the Inyan. The matter of slavery within the context of greater Jewish society of the rabbinic age, and thinking about that institution from biblical times up to their time as rabbinic thinkers. What I wanted to do, since so many questions have come up for us, and I don't expect to do another Masechet that deals with laws of slavery in all its particulars as a choice for Talmud class in general into the future. What I wanted to really do is, while we're in this inyan, that is a Hebrew word that really means the matter, the bigger topic, what I wanted to do is also introduce people to some of the thinking behind this institution of slavery from Torah. So we're going to look at a few Torah texts at a given point after we learn a passage from Masechet Gittin tonight. I want to go back to some Torah texts, talk about this institution. And I want to talk about some of the answers, potential answers, which may not be satisfying entirely, I just will tell you now, but some potential answers to some of the questions that have come up around the table. This is the heavy lifting part, Ron.
Okay.
What have some thinkers said regarding this institution on the whole? And Eric asked it in short form. I think you've asked it in different ways. How could this exist? What is it that this is trying to teach? If we were allowed slaves in Torah, if we were dealing with slavery in the time of the rabbis, what is this saying about humanity and our nature as Jewish people? And we're going to look at a few sources, including Samson Raphael Hirsch, including Harav Cook, and some other thinkers that address this issue. Given the Gemara that we're studying, the Gemara in Kedushin, which talks about both Canaanite and Hebrew slaves, and there are a few passages within Kedushin. Masechet Kedushin is a wonderful place to go for a few pages. One time maybe we'll look at it in a different context about mitzvot on the parents and what they have to give for their children and what's it mean to have a relationship, a wedlock, things like this. But it also deals with some of the foundational questions of Canaanite slaves specifically and Hebrew slaves specifically, and there are a few points within the last couple of weeks, having learned that on the Daf Yomi cycle, on the daily Daf cycle, there are a few points that are worth noting in the Gemara and in the Tosafot on some Gemaras concerning the matter, again, of slavery on the whole, Avdut. That's a tall order for one class. It may take us two. Before Pesach is the perfect time to be thinking about it. But from our Gemara, we're going to see and revisit one small piece that I read before, which might ring true to the ears or might be a reminder of what we read, but we'll look at it a little bit more deeply in terms of some Rashi on the portion when it comes to some of the commentary here about freeing slaves and what it means to think about slaves in terms of property, in terms of human beings, and in terms of the way we treat them. Okay, back into the Gemara now. Lamed Chet Amud Bet. I'm on 38b1, if you're following in the English version of the Gemara in Schottenstein. 38b1, and I'm on the word Gufa, if you're inside the Vilna, five lines down. Gufa, Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda says in the name of Shmuel, Kol HaMashachar Avdo Over Ba'ase. Anybody who frees or emancipated a Canaanite slave, talking Canaanite slaves again, transgresses the positive commandment. And this is the brief story about what? The minyan. Remember we read this? So just to put it into context again, I'm going to just fly through this since we've read it. We actually read it twice. Shneamar la'olam behem ta'avodu. You should say about the Canaanite slaves, you shall work them forever. But meitivei, there was an incident involving humase, but Rabbi Eliezer, shenichnas levedah knesset velo mata asara, who entered a synagogue and couldn't find 10 men, meaning the community just couldn't provide. V'shichar avdo v'hishlim al asara, and he freed the slave and he made the minyan. The Gemara further answers, mitzvah shane, if I want somebody to be able to do a mitzvah, then maybe that's the real reason to free somebody and make them part of the Jewish people. And that then leads to the Midrashic conversation. Do we really allow for this shichrur? Do we really allow for this freeing of slaves? Or do we not really allow for this? And so, ultimately, it's taught in a braita, Rabbi Eliezer Omer Chova. Rabbi Eliezer says it's an obligation to work slaves. They may not be emancipated. Since Rabbi Eliezer himself says that the freeing of slaves is forbidden, it must be that he was permitted to free his slave, because what? He knew that the community needed a tenth and that there's a mitzvah to do and you couldn't do the mitzvah and he needs for a minyan. Okay. And we talked about whether or not it's the larger freeing entirely or just, the question came up time and again, is it only for the minyan? And we said, it's entirely. It's entirely. He's really freed. Further, Gemara is going to go on the right-hand column in the English on the last paragraph on page 38B1. Amar Rabba. Rabba says the following. Bahane tlat mile. These three things cause what? Nachate bale batim. Cause householders to lose their wealth. So we're talking now economic realities. There's a loss of wealth. What are the three things? Demafke avadaihu lecheruta. They release their slaves to freedom. Udesaire nichsaihu b'shabata. They inspect their, bless you, they inspect their property on the Sabbath. Udekave udaitaihu b'shabata be'idan be'midrasha. And because they reschedule their meals on the Sabbath at the time of the rabbi's drush, in the Beit Midrash. Okay? Three things. So the Gemara comes to say, you better think twice about freeing a slave because there's some loss of wealth that you might suffer if you really keep this method going. You could find, in other words, the inner commentary is this, I think. You could find lots of mitzvot that your slaves ultimately could be enjoined to. This could be a real way that we could just say everybody should be doing mitzvot and everybody should be freed. Be careful. And, of course, if you go with the Sfarah that it is, ultimately, even including Rabbi Eliezer, because he seemed to say in the Braita that I agree that in general there is a mitzvah aseh, there's a positive Torahidic mitzvah to keep them working and not free them, then I ought to really watch myself, because it's not just a matter of they lose their wealth. It's a matter of what? They lose their wealth. You're in for big losses if you free a slave, and big losses this world and the next. In other words, no mitzvah. You don't want to be violating mitzvahs. You don't want to be violating mitzvot. Now, this is an interesting group of three things. Because here, slaves and not giving up the slaves are combined with inspecting property on the Sabbath and making meals at the time of the rabbi's drush on the Sabbath.
You couldn't invite to that, but...
Huh? Right. So, just keep that in mind and think about why those three things might be packaged together. Okay? Keep that in mind. What I want to look at is a little bit more about this whole Shabbat thing for a minute. Because here's the textual curiosity for me. In the midst of deep discussions concerning slaves, slave law, Braitas about slavery, material about gets shichror, emancipation documents, the rabbis are sure to make mention of Shabbos. The rabbis are sure to at least have one limud, one section of learning that has to do with the Sabbath. I think very important, just by way of a note, that the Gemara would include such a limud. Now, it could be simply said that Rabbah always packaged these three together and taught them, and that's the simple answer. But there's also, in my estimation, a reason why we have such limudim, we have such a mention in terms of one's wealth and in terms of one's observance of Shabbat, and that is that all of this discussion, remember, Kana'an, Eved Kana'an or Eved Ivri, Canaanite slave or Hebrew slave, you have to be loyal to the Sabbath. And you have to let them be loyal to the Sabbath. And therefore you have to be very careful. If one is circumcised and already gone to mikveh and part of the community, you really have to think seriously about how much, what? You're going to create a Sabbath culture that not only includes you and your family, but all of, quote-unquote, the mouths you have to feed. Your economic situation, it might feel nice to have a house full of avadim, a house full of servants and slaves. But remember, with us, there is a link between your including them in your household and the performance of mitzvot that you're obligated for and that you must allow them to perform and enjoy. And so, in a certain way, I think it's brought up on the first level to say, Shabbat is a big institution, and it's a big institution not only for you. Secondly, careful, because, you know, sometimes you think you're gaining an asset, whereas it's going to cost you a lot more by way of energy and investment. And you better be careful. What is this whole issue, though, of inspecting the property on the Sabbath? So, we know, and if you look down below in the footnote, it says, V'chibadato me'asot derachecha mimitzo chetzecha v'daber davar. You have to conduct your affairs of business during the week, because you refrain from conducting all affairs of business on the Sabbath itself. And with very few constructs of Sabbath law beyond the way that we see the legislation working in Torah, don't go and collect on the Sabbath day itself or else you'll be punished by death, mot yumat, and don't prepare fire, lo tvaru esh b'chol mekomotechem, you shouldn't have any fire and kindle any fire b'moshvotechem, sticha, in any of your encampments or dwellings. We really have two primary institutions of Sabbath law spelled out, one Torahitically and one from the prophets. And it's a refraining from business, and it's a refraining from fire. Fire as, yes, symbolic of creative power, but very frankly, fire as fire itself. Don't light a fire, kindle a fire, make food in the fire. Just refrain. These are the institutions, primary institutions, and when it comes to the agrarian way of life that many lead at this time, there has to be an expansion on what is seen as commerce and seen as your business as defined by Isaiah. And the way that it's done is in a braita in the Gemara in Masechet Eruvin. And so what's made reference to here in Eruvin is the following braita. Now they're talking about an Eruv. Remember what an Eruv is. An Eruv is that legal kind of literal construct, the fence, if you will, done in a proper halachic manner. Doesn't look like a chain link fence or even a regular good old wooden fence, but it is a series of, what do you call these in construction?
The jams
and the lintel frames.
Right.
It's basically a series of frames and that goes around an area that. But there's also other types of eruvs, right? That I can basically cook on one day for another day is an eruv tavshilin, a cooking eruv. Then there's an eruv chatzerot, an eruv that links my dwelling place to somebody else's so I can bring my food there. Okay, that's the larger context. A lot of this discussion in Eruvin is simply, as we've said before when we were learning Shabbat in this Beit Midrash, Masechet Shabbat, the tractate of the Sabbath. It's a continuation of Sabbath discussions because Eruvin are so important for Yom Tov and Shabbat. On page 38, the following. Says about someone in the name of Rabbi Bar Rav Hanin. Amar le Rabba Bar Rav Hanin la Abaye. Rabba Bar Rav Hanin says to Abaye, De Tanya, here is what we learn in a Braita. Lo Yahale Chadam Lesof Sadehu Leida mahi tzricha. Lo yahale chadam lesof sadehu. Leida mahi tzricha. A person should not walk to the end of his field on a Sabbath to determine what work and repair it requires. So first of all,
it's not there.
I'm reading from Eruvin, page 38 in Eruvin, just to enlighten us about what it happens to be the same page. Right. Very easy to confuse.
And the same thought.
But in a little bit more of expansive way. So the Limud says that on a Sabbath, you have to be careful not to walk out to the end of a field and start thinking about everything that needs to get done in the field right after the Sabbath or the next morning.
But it's okay to walk out if you're not thinking.
Oh, so what is it okay to walk out? What is it okay to actually do? He says, Kiyotsebo, as also similar or similarly, Lo yitayel adam al petach medina kadesh yikanes lamerchas miyad. A person shouldn't stroll to the entrance of the city or to some faraway place at the end of your area that you're allowed to walk in during the Sabbath in order to enter the bathhouse immediately at the conclusion of Shabbat. Now, what's the problem there?
People will leave shul too early to
maybe. And you're preparing for after Shabbat. You don't. First of all, there's a general category here of not preparing for after the Sabbath. People don't pack on Saturdays if they're leaving. People wouldn't talk about what's going on Saturday night in many ways. The Shulchan Aruch comes to tell you there are a few things you can talk about on the Sabbath. If you're hiring teachers for the community, you're allowed to even talk about the number of apples you'll pay the person. It's a teacher. If you have an obligation for a chuppah, for a wedding, or to make arrangements for funerals, you're allowed to talk these things through. But one shouldn't really make plans. So what's the spirit here? That if you're going to constantly work and go and take a cheshbon, take an accounting of what your field needs on any given Sabbath, and that's what you're going to occupy your time, you're really not creating Sabbath culture. You're not creating Sabbath observance for yourself.
You haven't turned off your cell phone.
That's right. So what's the analog today?
Well,
Right? That is one of them. That is one of them. Just turn off. And...
But it's an interesting example because thinking is not exactly creating things, you know?
But it's
intent.
And
walking is okay.
They're trying to avoid the intent.
I know.
Yeah. So that's an interesting point. And the Gemara comes to say, Lohi, wait a minute. I don't think that's exactly the case. Listen to how it picks up on your thought, Bobby. Shma leiv lo hadar be. There wouldn't have been any kind of real
infringement
here. Hata. We're talking about a different law that somebody once was talking about that there couldn't be... let me just skip forward to what it's going to say. Lov mochcha miltahu. It's not clear anywhere in this case what's exactly going on if the guy walks that direction and says nothing. Tsurva me rabbananhu. If it's a Torah scholar walking out through those fields, Amarinan, we might say about him, Shmata Meshachte, that his study pulled him, that he's going over time and again the Mishnah that he just learned, or the lesson that he just learned in the Beit Midrash. So let's, you know, Dan Lachaf Sechut, in other words, we have a Mishnah in Pirkei Avot that says, Dan Lachaf Sechut. Judge favorably. Judge in the scale of merit. Well, if he's a Tsurba de Rabbanan, which is an interesting expression for one of the Chachamim, which comes from either Tsurba or Tsaveret, which connotes something hot and scorching like fire. So if somebody's hot on their lessons and is going over them time and again, maybe they're going to walk to the edge of the field. And we don't just immediately say, oh, that guy is probably inspecting everything. By the way, there were some rabbis whose positions were simply to be Torah scholars, but some who owned orchards and some who owned fields. And therefore, we would think that maybe it could be one and the same person. And the Gemara here is asking, well, what are you going to think of this person? Are you going to give him credit for the learning that he's probably going over and his thinking and his taking a stroll? Or are you going to say, oh, the guy's probably out there doing business and figuring out exactly what he needs to do at the end of the Sabbath.
We have the precedent of Isaac. That's how we got Menachem.
Right. Isaac went out to
the
Lasuach Basadeh
to
meditate in the field.
He was meditating in a positive
way. That's nice. They did not bring that proof, Barry, but you could write a commentary.
Another chapter.
That's right. And then,
so bright,
what if it's not a chacham? What if it's not a recognizable student?
Should they have the same schut?
Okay, so let's see what the Gemara says. Does he have the same schut? V'am ha'aretz, you know, because remember we call that person am ha'aretz, just a simple guy, an everyday guy. V'im am ha'aretz hu, if he's an am ha'aretz, amarinan, we say about him. Hamara irkasle. Perhaps he lost his donkey. And he's going out and he lost his donkey. Now, I have to tell you that when I read this line, I actually chuckled out loud because one time I went to the city of Tzfat with a friend of mine named Michael Schwartz, Rabbi Michael Schwartz. And we were staying at what is a very famous place there when you are young and on a journey and figuring out where you live in the Jewish space and time of the world. You go and you can stay at the mystical place of Ascent in Tzfat. It is a youth hostel run by some overly mystically inclined, let's say, Keruv specialists, those who bring you... Very so,
hallucinary drug.
maybe that was it.
Okay.
So it was a little bit overdone, and interestingly, we also had a room and an invite at the local Masorti Shul. It was at the time that actually there was a conservative synagogue in Tzfat. No, I understand it's not really there today. But long story short, we wound up that Sabbath in the afternoon taking a long stroll. If anybody's ever been to Tzfat, there's kind of a up on top, there's all kinds of, there's a midrachov, there's a place where you can walk, and shops on the side, and then there's a little bit of a down here kind of cityscape with little hotels and buildings and things like that, and then down here is the cemetery of Tzfat, which is a unique experience in and of itself, and little pathways to all the synagogues in the city, and down the steps, down the steps, down the steps, and then finally, there's a whole area, the whole, from Tzfat, you can look over this valley, and it's a beautiful, lush, green valley, and it's a fantastic place, and there are some paths. So we're on the walk, and we are on this path, and one of the guys looks at us and says, did you guys lose a bull? And I say, what do you mean, did we lose a bull? He said, well, you must be out here walking because you lost a bull. And I finally understand that he was actually calling us Am Ha'aretz, ignoramus. I finally figured this out today. This was a Talmudic insult. It took me all these decades. I gotta find that guy. I gotta find that guy. I'll tell you the end of the story. I don't know if he was really insulting us, because he was telling us, be careful, there's a bull wandering around here. And literally, there was a bull wandering around there. And we encountered this huge beast of an animal. And these two guys are running over from their kibbutz, trying to find this crazy beast of burden. It looked somewhere between an ox and a bull. Not sure which it was, but it was really funny. So when I was preparing today and I found this Gemara, I remember that. Anyhow, so you shouldn't do business on the Sabbath, is one of the points. And you should, if you can't really figure out what you're going to do with your field, I think the point here, and we're going to see this in a later text in some of the ones that I collected, the point here is, what does your thinking about being a slave owner and slave master have to look like in terms of your Sabbath observance? Sabbath observance can be what you cook and how you cook it. Sabbath observance can be what you light and what you don't light. Sabbath observance can be what davening you say, what tefillot you say, what prayers you say, what Torah reading you're going to do. But Sabbath observance is also a mindset. And the uniqueness of this spot in the Gemara in this world of talking about slave ownership is a reminder that Sabbath observance is more than just those ritual kinds of realities. It's actually a mindset. And part of the mindset is to forget the shikul, forget the debate. Do I release my slave? Do I keep my slave? What kind of work does he have to do? What kind of work am I? I have to stop working myself. I have to stop working others. I have to stop being the master. Because after all, Sabbath day is about God's mastery of the universe.
Hi.
Hi.
I was actually expecting Sarah to be here.
No? She was here last week.
Okay, so I'll
let her know you said hello.
One week behind myself, but quite a lot of daylight savings time.
So the Sabbath becomes, in this spot in the Gemara, the reminder that you are not the master, God is the master. This might be a human institution, but this is the day of God. This is the day of rest. And so I think that there's a profound message within here, the hypertext reality of just that one little piece in the Brayta.
So are we being redeemed that have to work for life for God?
Yeah, I mean, for all intents and purposes, we absolutely are the Avdei Hashem. We are the Avadim to Kodesh Baruch Hu, to the creator of the universe in that way. And that transformation is the one that, in some ways, philosophically, mentally, really escapes us, though. Because We didn't learn that lesson soon enough, and that gets back to the questions we've been asking in various ways. How could God allow for slavery to be an institution in the world? Well, you should have learned that lesson, that it absolutely has no place when it comes to being slaves in Egypt. And I freed you. But you didn't learn that exactly. And you're not accepting on yourselves the kind of avdut that I expect from you through giving you Torah and giving you instruction and giving you mitzvot to do. And so when you don't abide by those things, you're obviously, you've fallen off of that kind of moral plane. I'm talking about this creating a morality plane, a morality structure for the world, God's looking at the Jewish people and says, and therefore, I'm going to provide for you the institution of slavery. You like to have people who you command in this way, I see. There is a part of you that's like Pharaoh in that way. Now, this is a very real conversation. Again, I said at the outset, we're going to look at some texts down the line that talk about this as the reason why Torah could ever withstand slavery as a matter of societal reality in addition to rabbinic culture. So we're really there.
So is that a punishment?
In a certain way, there is a freeing ourselves of that kind of ba'alut, that kind of mastery over other human beings that slave ownership allows for within the Sabbath. And I believe, as small a quip as it was, in the middle of this conversation about laws, that's the point.
The Olam Ba'em Ta'avodu, we understood from here that it's a mitzvah, correct?
Translate so that others can...
God says that for Eved Knani, we must force them to work for us forever.
Right.
So, if it's a mitzvah, what a poor Jewish guy does if he has no money to buy a slave, if I must have this mitzvah to...
No, it's not a positive mitzvah to actually acquire one. It's a positive mitzvah if one is within your ownership to actually make sure that they do their work in that case, if you go with that thought, that it means there is no emancipating them forever.
So if I make a check, I should buy slaves. That's what
you suggested, that it might sound like there's a mitzvah to buy slaves. My answer was that there's no positive mitzvah to purchase one or find one.
But if I buy, I should make sure that you...
If you acquire one, then yes,
I have responsibility.
You have responsibility.
Forever.
Yeah. And what that avodah looks like, we're learning about as the discussions unfold. It doesn't mean you do whatever you like. It means you have certain obligations.
I guess, the way you framed it, my response is that being a slave owner makes it almost impossible for you to enjoy Shabbat, because slaves need direction. They need to be instructed. They need to be directed. They need to be mastered and told what to do. And to that extent, it's work.
I think there's a little bit more of recognition of humanity within that slave community or slave family that you exist with. And actually, it's the suggestion, after looking at some of the texts here and in Kiddushin recently, there's a reality that they're going to have their own family experience, their own community structure, and what the Torah and these mitzvot are trying to do in certain cases, in terms of the dialectic, is release you a little bit from being in that space of ba'alut, of giving rules and defining laws and this and that,
right,
because you have to create a Sabbath atmosphere for everyone.
Right.
So you can enjoy that Sabbath.
Right, but...
And then we'll get to Laura.
Well, again, I'm probably totally wrong here, but I was thinking about whether or not this injunction of having them work, not emancipating them, isn't, in fact, trying to put them on automatic pilot so that you're freed from these responsibilities that obviously are inconsistent with the Sabbath culture you're describing, meaning a Sabbath culture in which, to me, if you're thinking about what you're going to do in a field the next day, that seems to me a lot less intrusive on Sabbath culture than sitting around and directing people as to where they have to go and what they have to do. That seems to me to be not focusing on the Torah and mm-hmm. learning and all the rest. These are all mm-hmm. distractions from them. And therefore, maybe this is an attempt to say that if you're in this situation, you need to have created a process that frees you from that.
Yeah. I would agree with that, that the more we free ourselves of that, either side of that, then we live more of that Sabbath. Yeah, I agree. Laura?
I think we've defined slaves in our discussion here as being people without any intellectual property or capital, and people who are, you know, let's say, menial laborers. And I just don't think that's the reality that we're talking about. Slaves traditionally are sought because they bring intellectual capital with them. And the reason you might want not to emancipate them is because you don't want them setting up a parallel economic system to the system that you own and you control. And so if I look at it that way, which I know has a great foundation in ancient Near East among
For
other
sure.
cultures, it makes all the sense in the world to me what you're talking about, and the fact that you want them to have, let's say, a respectable living situation. I mean, I'm not going to define it in any greater detail, also makes all the sense in the world to me, because you want to get the economic and the societal value out of what they're bringing to your society.
Yeah, I think we've been fighting against totally just talking about them as menial labor.
We tend to keep moving.
Yeah, so we have to. So we have to be careful about that. So we have to be careful about that.
That's exactly the point.
No doubt about it. And as a matter of fact,
in the Torah, it says they brought 1,000 slaves because they were the eyeglass. I mean, you know, for Pop Paul, they were called the eyeglass people.
Right.
What did they call them in the Torah?
Well, they're definitely skilled laborers when it comes to the wood.
Right.
And if you look at what the first message in Torah is, which is the first page of the handout, which I'm not going to give out yet, but I included the story of Joseph as the first story of brothers
right.
selling brothers into slavery, right? And what do we realize about the slave system in Egypt? Again, to get away from just the we were whipped to build the mud bricks, Joseph as the slave in Potiphar's house, who comes with the economic power that the Jewish people represent within history, right? And that in some ways, the enslavement continues to be a reflection, in this way, I won't turn it all the way into the Jewish thought that I'll say for the total end, but again, think about what that's saying in terms of slavery and its benefits to society and why it's so hard an institution to actually get rid of and what kind of responsibility I have to these people. And by the way, the Torah and our Gemara's work to very much limit the kind of damage and cruelty we can physically inflict, in addition to creating a culture where they're participating in many ways within that society. And the story, I'm going to go back to a minute, the story of the minion now takes on whole new meaning in that vein, because he's really debating about whether or not I'm going to lose out on the economic capital I've built into not only my own household, but all of society by having this slave emancipated. So this is core question about slavery as an institution.
Not just economics at the root. If you have a group of people who are like another nation, another religion, and you subjugate them, you make sure that they don't threaten your identity. So by keeping them suppressed and oppressed and slaves, you make sure that there's no mingling, there's no nisui tarovet, there's no keep the purity of who you are.
Intermarriages
and all that. So keeping the purity of the ethnical or religious identity. And because this is so important as the Jews coming
right.
into Canaan, so to keep it straight, to keep the differences clear, lo olam ba'em ta'avod, to make sure that they are oppressed and suppressed.
Except
otherwise, it creates
no society stays suppressed. Every suppressed society rebels.
I'm not talking about that. I'm just talking about that.
Yeah, as an institution of why Torah.
I'm talking about that.
And I agree with you that it was set up in such a way so that we would become able to define a culture.
What?
On the other hand, it's also very obvious that it's that there are economics and the economic reasons behind it. So I would say that the cultural element that you're thinking about when it comes to lo l'darkam, mm-hmm. don't establish religions according to their ways and don't allow your people to intermarry and this and that. By this time in the Gemara, remember, there are times when we see them being integrated and becoming full Jews. That's an interesting piece then, right? But they're being assimilated into our culture by then, and that's the kind of cultural hegemony that you're talking about in observing why perhaps in Torah the system was introduced in terms of that Jewish incursion into Canaan and inheritance of the land promised and the need to establish their own kingdom. But that wasn't without the kind of relationships with people who they would keep either at bay in these roles or decide how to bring them in.
Well, by the time of this rabbinical discussion, it's obvious from all the nuances here that it is an attempt to be more humanitarian, more considering, more
Yeah, I mean, some people are going to really agree with you, and even up, right up to modern commentaries who are trying to figure out, by comparison, what did we do versus what happened in other cultures.
You cannot change the whole system for economic reasons, but at least you can make it more livable.
Yeah,
more
I mean, there are people definitely who tend that way and say, we just couldn't get rid of it for all its benefit. Okay, he said, weren't the Hebrews slaves? And yeah, the answer was that they were slaves.
The Hebrews were slaves.
Yeah.
Until the Jubilee.
We had Eved Ivri. We had the institution of Hebrew slaves. 6 years, and then they would go out for nothing. Unless they chose to stay around.
Not for nothing. You need to give him everything he accumulated in your home.
Well, you actually owe him money.
Yeah, you owe him. And even if he has a wife, you need to let the wife go and everyone.
Yeah.
How does that fit with the idea that you're supposed to keep them forever?
Non-Jews.
Yeah, we're talking non-Jews here versus Jewish slaves there.
So the non-Jews in the Jubilee year do not go.
Correct.
They stay.
No, they stay. Correct. All right.
They
never go. Unless we made them Jewish and we emancipate them already.
Well, then they're Jewish.
Then they should go.
They marry a Jewish woman.
Right. You guys are getting the law. This is good. And they schedule their meals on the Sabbath at the time of the rabbi's lecture in the study hall. This is going to do you in. And take it from me, it really happens. So you need to come to... So I just want to read...
There are people who say we should have Kiddush at 11 o'clock, but I'm not mentioning
it. We definitely should have Scotch hour at 11 o'clock. And then come
are.
Back to synagogue. Come back to... You know where I am?
We're all downstairs at 11.
Whoa.
Just for a second, then we'll come back.
Okay. So what is this Be'idon Be Midrasha? Those of us who learned Talmud chapter 16 together might remember that there was this institution of coming back in the afternoon to hear the rabbis discern from Torah, drash from the Torah, what the laws were that we needed to learn. Created this culture of Beit Midrash for the general populace in addition to the sages themselves. So there was this listening, and some believe the beginning, really, of these shared homiletical midrashim that are now in collections, like Tanhuma literature, the earliest strata of Midrash Tanhuma, or some of the midrash we have from Vayikra Rabbah, or from strands from Bereshit Rabbah. This is the capital M midrashic genre, and how those are built with a quote from Psalms and then a wandering back through some Parsha connection and then into a message about redemption. These are all potential religious messages that stemmed out of groups that were more into thinking about the redemption and what God's redemption was going to look like, and we've talked about that from Sanhedrin, that there are those who were interested in those questions, and there are some midrash and homiletical material that are less involved and more midrashic and halachic, and therefore they learn Jewish law, and that really is part of what you need to come to the Beit Midrash for, so that you can hear this redemptive quality of discussion, which today people say homiletically is a good place to, a good note, and a halachic discourse, which also for the Jewish people is important. And you see that Rashi says, if you're with me on Lamed Chet Bet, in the narrow lines, probably about, 10 lines down, end of the line, Be'idan Be Midrasha. Just to read inside a little bit of the Rashi here on this part of the Gemara. Keshe ha-chacham doresh drashot l'rabim, when the sage, who's local or who's visiting, makes midrashic understandings come alive to the public, v'hem yoshvin v'suda, but they're busy eating their meal instead of listening to the sage. V'hayalahem lakdim ol acher, and they should have made plans about their meal being a little earlier or a little later. Okay, now Rashi, I always say this. Rashi, Troy, France, Ashkenaz, right? He also wants to make sure he's pointing out, when he chooses what to comment on, things that are very important in the diaspora. And he, I believe, always has a little bit of on his mind how to build Shabbos culture within the diasporic community. So he's giving a little advice. You can make it a little later. You can make it a little earlier. Why do you have to make it right then?
Well, French eating habits are very important.
That's right. That's right.
It's cultural to this day, you know. It's fascinating. Anybody who's brought up in French culture knows that the kids are obligated to eat all the different foods in school. I mean, there's a whole, it's a completely different eating culture from birth on.
Fascinating. So let's see what this timing culture wound up making the rabbi's comments on here further. Da'amar Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Now I'm on the first column on the left side of 38b2 if you're in the English Talmud with me. So Rabbi Chiya Bar Abba says in the name of Rabbi Yochanan, Shtei Mishpachot Hayu B'Yerushalayim. He's reporting on two families in Jerusalem. Achat kavasudata b'shabta, one of whom scheduled its meal on the Sabbath day at the time of the rabbi's lecture. Ve'achat kavasuda b'erev Shabbat. Ushtehen nekru, and one scheduled a meal on the Sabbath eve, and the both of them lost out big time.
So we shouldn't
think on Yom Shishi. Oh, nice. So let's look at this. Let's look at the Rashi. What does that mean? One did it at the daytime. We can understand Shabbata because Shabbata is the Yom Shabbat. Shabbata is the day of Shabbos. And therefore, we don't want to have them schedule their meal at the time that the rabbis give the drush on the day of Shabbat. But you tell me that there's a family that actually lost out because they scheduled a meal on Friday night? The Erev Shabbat? Is that what you're saying? Rashi is going to explain. Was it really Erev Shabbat, Rashi asks? The Erev Shabbat. Belele Shabbat, on the evening of Sabbath, they really had a big meal. The Ein Kan Kavod Shabbat. And this is not the way to really respect Shabbat. Friday night should not be the time you really make Shabbos. This is the suggestion. Rashi is writing from a cultural and halachic standpoint that he understands. Friday night is not really the time to make Shabbos. Dekaimalan kavod yom kodim lichvod laila. Because we have a halachic principle that says that the Sabbath day should be respected by the Sabbath meal of the day of Shabbat versus making a big meal on the nighttime of the Sabbath. Comes from Masechet Shabbat. And if you look at really where it's noted in halachic sources, we will see that it's in Masechet Pesachim. So it's in page 105 of the tractate Passovers, Paschal Offerings. By the way, you learn a lot about the Sabbath in Masechet Shabbat. You learn a lot about the Sabbath in Eruvin. You hear a little bit about the Sabbath in lots of places. You learn a lot about the Sabbath in the 10th chapter of Pesachim. And definitely I'm thinking that, you know, it could be Pesach all year next year, potentially, for Gemara. So, all right. So what? Where do we learn that principle, or what happened here? Behem hayu mitkavnim bishvil bitul beta midrash. And they were thinking that when they established this principle, that they didn't really want people to cancel out on coming to the Beit Midrash. And they really said, you got to schedule in the right way. You got to have Shabbos meal and respect Shabbat, and you also have to respect the Beit Midrash. Now, Rashi does something very interesting, which Rashi does sometimes in the Torah commentary that he writes, as well as the Talmud commentary that's here on our page. And that is, he says, I have another way of understanding this. Ve'ika demefarshe, and there are also those who make the following commentary and understand it a little differently. Be'erev Shabbat mamish. We're not talking about Leil Shabbat, because that, in Talmudic terminology, Leil Shabbat is Friday night dinner. Erev Shabbat in halachic literature is what? Friday. Friday before Shabbat. So what these people are doing is, Friday before Shabbat, they were making a big meal. V'chein b'chol yom merov osher, as they would make a huge meal every afternoon, talk about eating habits, as they would make a big meal every afternoon because of their wealth and their ability to make a big feast, bo bayom, while it was still daylight, and in this case on Friday, aval baha mi ha'ika isura shikanes l'shabbos kashehu sova belo tava. And you would have a problem because in this case, you would satisfy yourself, you would eat to satisfaction, you would fill yourself up in such a way that you would not enter the Sabbath, that you wouldn't go into Shabbat with ta'ava, with an appetite and desirous of the Sabbath tastes, and to make Shabbat meal have that extra spice that Shabbat represents, because you're so filled up, you're so full. Your belly's so full. And that's why they lost out. Because they, in this lesson about Sabbath culture that the Gemara presented, they mistakenly filled themselves up on Friday. Now, this is a reality to this day, right? Because you have people who on Fridays eat a little breakfast and then do not eat lunch. And for sure you have people, even if they eat a little lunch, who do not bench motzi for lunch. They will not eat a sandwich, they won't have a roll, they don't have any kind of bread on a Friday during the day. And they also avoid anything that is filling, and if that, you know, 3:30, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock snackiness comes, right, there are only certain foods available in households where Sabbath comes real. And you want to make sure that you go into Shabbat B'tava.
Sort of like not eating matzah the day before Passover.
Not eating matzah from Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Yeah. We even back it up further so that you have the whole month. There are those who would say definitely, for sure, not the day before Pesach. When you make a suda, if you're fasting and you're a firstborn, and you want to eat a meal for that Suda, there are those who would say, starting from the very morning before Pesach, don't even eat things that look like a meal. Just little tastes. Okay, so that's the Sabbath element within the sources. And We then have a piece of the Gemara that's going to go right back into some of the laws concerning slavery. And we're going to talk about the economic realities of slavery. Amar Rav, Amar Rav. Rabba says in the name of Rav, Hamakdish avdo yatza lecheirut. If one consecrates his slave, meaning he's going to promise him to the Beit HaMikdash, we're going to promise him to the temple, we're going to make him hekdesh le Beit HaMikdash. We're going to sanctify, we're going to what's called hakdasha, hekdesh. My tama, why does he go out to freedom? Gufei lo kadish, the slave's body can't be consecrated, meaning his body can't be used by the temple either as a sacrifice or as material for the temple. And
you wouldn't sacrifice a man. What do you mean?
So that's right, that's what they're saying. So if a person was to be makdish his eved, if a person was to say, I'm makdish my eved, what do you think, that we're sacrificing human beings here? And we're giving them up as material for the Beit HaMikdash? No. Now, there are four different kinds of notes here. One is that you have kedushat mizbeach. You can sanctify property for an altar. Okay? You can also have kedushat bedek habayit. You can have a consecration for the upkeep of the temple. All these things are either animals or money. You can also make a hakdasha for the amount, the value of some property to the temple. Ah, that could be. If a guy says, I'm going to makdish my eved, I say, oh, I'm going to commit the value of my eved, all the bounty that I received through his help, I'm going to pledge that in tzedakah to the temple, and you can actually evaluate, or what's it called when you have a property assessment?
Appraise.
Appraise your property, and you can donate, or makdish, the appraisal value of your property, or some portion of your property, to the temple. These are all things we know can happen.
Yeah, but we study, we cannot have the eved as a collateral.
Right, because you can't put his body up for it.
So
here it's a whole different story. We're talking about hekdesh, we're talking about for the temple. Can't learn one to the other all the time. L'dame lo kamar. But the master didn't state his value exactly. D'lahave am kadosh kamar. Rather, we have to say that his slave is becoming a member of the Am Kadosh. If he says Makdish, we mean to say that we could consider him saying, no, I make him a totally free guy. He's going to become part of Am Kadosh. That's a very interesting kind of reality. Because now, I'm asking a person who owns slaves to think about the connection I have between what I donate in the name of God to my central temple or to the Kohanim, the upkeep of the Jewish people, and whether or not I'm willing to use the same verb to, in a certain way, convert my slave to a full member of the Jewish people and be part of Am Kadosh, be part of the Jewish people. So that is the proposition of the Gemara in the next spot after this discussion concerning the minyan and concerning whether or not people ought to free their slaves and what it's going to mean if you do. Now, the Gemara says, for Rav Yosef Amar Rav, Rav Yosef says in the name of Rav, Hamafkir Avdo Yatza Lecheirut. If one declares a slave ownerless, makes him hefker, because we have this principle that there's certain material that we can say is hefker, it's ownerless. Nobody can claim it. His slave goes out to freedom. The Gemara elaborates, Manda Amar Makdish, the one who says that if one consecrates a slave, he goes free. In other words, the use of the term Makdish that Rava brought up, if he sets the slave as being Kadosh, because he uses the verb with kuf dalet shin at the core and frees the slave. Kol shekein mafkir, isn't it the more so? The someone who uses the verb mem fei Kuf Yud Resh, that one declares a slave ownerless, the slave goes free. I have the parallel kind of hypertext reality in my mind that when I say Makdish, just about the slave, it's both this kind of overlay of the systemic way we contribute value and property and sacrificial material to the temple. When he says Makdish et ha'eved, when he uses that verb that we use to do the temple system, and I free him because I say I want him to be part of Am Kadosh, for sure, if I say he has no owner, like property that I can make totally ownerless, have no claim on whatsoever, for sure, if I use that verb, I'm going to have the slave go free. We have in our economic system a way of relinquishing all ownership of property. So these verbs sound like very interesting ways to free somebody. One happens to say I'm making him into a total Jew. One, though, Kol Shekain, all the more so frees him. But did it effectively make him part of Am Kadosh? I'm left with that question if I have this debate. What verb did I use? What did I say? And what kind of freedom did he attain? Aval Makdish Lo, the guy who says Mafkir is the one to use, says, no, I'm not going to allow for this other Makdish. Is that freeing him to say he's part of Am Kadosh? Boy, sounds like I'm making him a Jew, and that's the only way that I'm freeing him. I'm making him into fellow brother here. Dilma Ladame Kamar, perhaps the master meant to say that the value of the slave was consecrated, not the slave himself. Oh, that it wasn't actually a freeing term at all. That all it was the master who owned him giving the value of that slave to the Beit HaMikdash. So again, we get into a certain kind of...
That makes him free?
Make him free. Actually, it only allowed for the contribution.
So if you're making a contribution, why would you wait for the value?
Yeah, you can give any contribution.
Right. What was that whole rigmarole?
Yeah.
It's just the $18.
So the whole rigmarole is this, I think. Again, part of this is the Gemara's presentation of the way we have to think about slaves and our slave system. I'm using verbs here, and I'm potentially saying, you know, I think I'm going to pledge the value of 5 Shabbos dinners to the food fund at Congregation Or Zeruah, right? So I'm asking the question, is it capital I, and I'm being very generous, and you can blame me. I'm appreciative of my slave, and the notion of what we have going here systemically, I know I have to thank God for this. Makdish Dame De'evid. I'm going to pledge the value of my slave to the temple and the Beit HaMikdash.
It's a variant of redemption.
How so?
Well, because we redeem the firstborn, and we do it with money, because of the value to redeem, and we redeem when somebody gets kidnapped, right? We have that notion of equating, but we're continuing to equate people with value and money. So this is sort of like making the contribution in honor of the slave.
Right. I would think it's more about the contribution in honor versus paying for his full redemption, if that's the kind of redemption you're talking about. But maybe I hear in what you're saying not that kind of redemption. That which allows me to continue going on and living with this system and this slave doing this kind of work.
But I'm just saying,
it redeems me.
It's a culture in which the notion of paying for redemption and the equation of human life and dollar amounts is already embedded in the culture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And therefore, this type of transaction is not as strange to them as it sounds to us, is really what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
So the word that you use to say does not have an owner.
Hefker.
Is a woman hefker?
Yeah.
I'm in what sense? Before she's married, you mean?
I just want to know if the same word would apply to a woman, or is a woman understood as being owned?
No. No, that word is not...
It's a bad word, actually. It has negative connotations. Because it means that anybody can claim it, anybody can take it, anybody can use it. It's like public...
It's not so negative within the rabbinic economics
system. I know, but...
In modern slang, but
like
I don't think. Yeah, I think that the slang today is not really the sense in the Gemara. And Laura, if you're asking at any point, is a woman considered, quote unquote, when she's divorced or something like that, is she considered hefker?
No, she's owned by her husband.
No.
I want to know if the word, yes, but I want to know
no.
if the opposite applied also.
No, the word you might be thinking of or the kind of category you might be asking about would be whether or not a man is panui, available, and whether a woman is panuya, available.
No, that's not what I was asking, but okay.
But there is a concept of isha mufkeret.
It's a different
say again?
Yeah, I'm
right, so that we're not talking about that kind
different.
Of...
Do we use this word when we say on Passover that now this whatever I have, whatever hummus I have is ownerless and null?
Correct, we do. It's
so
in the formula.
The same
that's
word.
A very good way to say.
Right.
But that's the only time I've heard the word ownerless is when you do that every year for
yeah, but you sell it.
Yeah.
So somebody else sold it.
You know where we saw it recently?
No. This refers to this is what's
whatever
laying around.
Yes.
You don't know about it. It's nobody.
Right. What, you know where we saw it in a story about Mayor Rabbi Mayer in Ruria,
yeah.
as well, and Rabbi Mayer sees thieves in his house taking
right.
all the belongings.
Right.
And Ruria says, declare. Declare is a variant on the story. Maybe we didn't see the story, but declare all the property ownerless so that
it can't be stolen.
Yeah, we did that together? Okay. So, all right. So let me pass these around. I collected some pieces that, again, deepened the reflection on the matter of Avdut. And the first one we mentioned in passing, and we don't have to study it inside, but... These were, I hope will shed some light on some of the matters we've been discussing. If you take one and pass it along. I think there are enough here. Take one and pass it along from your side. The first one that we'll pass by quickly is just to mention, I put it here so that we can mention, Joseph was sold into slavery. And the slave system exists from Jews selling a fellow brother into the Midianites' hands, and the merchantmen sell him, and the Ishmaelites take him, and whatever way you see that, he's ultimately sold into the slavery that is presented in Torah as the central slavery, Avdut Shel Mitzrayim. Turn the page. Shemot 21:2. So we mentioned that there could be Hebrew servants, Kitikne Eved, Ivri, Sheish Shanim Yavod, 6 years an Eved will work, and the seventh he shall go out for free for nothing. Now that is just there to show you we have the Ivri category, we have the Eved Ivri, we have the Hebrew slave, but here's where the other comes in. As for thy bondmen and thy bondmaids whom thou mayest have, of the nations that are round about you, of them shall ye buy bondmen and bondmaids. Right. This is the old translation of Torah from, I believe, 1934, whatever it was online that I could have with these verses together. Now, I bring this up because people have asked whether or not the word Evan was used for these folks. And yeah, Eved was used for the male, and by the way, Amma was used for the female, giving some recognition that she's not exactly in the same category as the male slave to begin with. And Jay, actually, I think this has been a question that's been on my mind as I've learned more Gemaras and have been reading deeper about the whole issue of slavery in the time of the Talmud. Whether or not they would separate families was something that you had asked several weeks ago at the outset of the study that when we first encountered slavery. And so what it seems like is that it could very well be that we could have seen that happen, but it was most likely not. And there's what to say, though, that an eved and an ama, in terms of the way you wed and create families within the world of Jewish servants and slaves, they might be the ones to ultimately be put into a marriage relationship together, and yes, their children do become slaves as well. So there is systemically a way to continue this culture from the beginning of Torah's presentation. And of course, Vayikra is after Shemot. Leviticus is after Shemot. The question could very well be asked, why isn't it immediately outlawed entirely? And of course, we see the Torah's presentation of dealing with history as it unfolds among the nations where we live and we establish as being very real in terms of human experience. Back to Bobby's thoughts today about, you know, whether or not we are asked to think of ourselves as either slaves to God, and if we can't really think of ourselves only in that vein, what is it we have to contend with? So now Hirsch says the following. Look down below. Now, Samson Raphael Hirsch is writing in the 19th century, right? He's going to say the following. The consideration of certain circumstances is necessary, correctly to understand the fact that the Torah presupposes and allows the possession and purchase of slaves from abroad to a nation itself just released from slavery. No Jew could make any other human being into a slave. He could only acquire by purchase people who, by then universally accepted international law, were already slaves.
You need Bernie Sanders.
But this transference into the property of a Jew was the one and only salvation for anybody who, according to the prevailing laws of the nations, was stamped as a slave. The terribly sad experiences of even the last century, he's talking about some history he's reading, teach us how completely unprotected the Bible, unprotected and liable to the most inhuman treatment was the slave who, in accordance with the national law, was not emancipated, and even when emancipated, wherever he was, looked upon as still belonging to the slave class or as a freed slave. Now, you know that this is totally because of the landscape he was living in and the desire to matzdik et ha'am, to look at the Jewish people as having tzedakah always at the core, and their approach being always at that core. And you have to just understand the writings of someone so well known as to be thinking about this issue and hoping for everything righteous about the Jewish people's approach and the hope that it really was salvation for any of these folks. More importantly is the recognition within traditional commentary that the Torah presupposes and allows the possession and purchase of slaves from abroad to a nation itself just released from slavery. By stating it, we can see that as bringing up the very question. How could that possibly have been? And what do we do with that fact? Take a look at the next source. There's a Yiddish introduction to Uncle Tom's Cabin. And
in the 50s, but still,
well, it was the most read book.
And
it's the most influential book of the 19th century.
The King and I, and
there's a little history in the book.
The whole,
and the, you know,
to see how important it was.
Right. So, essential and important book. The reason why this became of interest to teachers and scholars within the Jewish world is because of the importance of that book and because of the ideas around slavery and Pesach and it being such a central feature of the Haggadah. I'm now trying to push through a little bit of it. I'm not a Yiddish expert by any means. Some people have done some translation work here, and I'm indebted to them. So, just read it in English. The slave trade was instituted among all peoples and in all lands in times immemorial. It is attested to in our Torah, which is the oldest book in the world. Well, I'm talking about a writer from 1868 writing in Yiddish. A trace of this shameful trade in human beings is found, for example, when Joseph is sold into slavery by his brothers. Yet it is likewise said that the trade grows out of the single phrase that Noah cursed upon his son Ham, when he rebuked him with these words, "Eved avadim yehiyeh lechav," a slave of slaves he will be unto his brothers. Now you know from your holy tales that slavery began on the Negroes, or Moors, who descend from Ham and came to be called Cushites by us Jews. With the passing of time, this evil spread over the white man as well, who descends from Shem and Yiftach.
That transition, it's hard to understand what's the precedent and what the verb and the noun, the verb and the subject are referring to. This evil spread over the white man.
The evil of enslaving people.
Oh, of enslaving.
Oh, sure, of course. Now, this reminded me, and I'm sorry I didn't copy it for you, but I don't know if anybody's ever read it, Winthrop Jordan's book, The White Man's Burden.
Sure.
Right, very famous book, very important book. And
that
was more, if I remember, mid-20th century. Right. And this notion that the world learned from the Bible and the world learned from the racial line how to both enslave and encapture people within this economic system.
Just to keep the facts straight, and one other error is that the brothers didn't sell them. It was the Midianites who sold them.
Right, to the Ishmaelites, if you want to use it that way, or the Midianites were the Midianites and the Ishmaelites together, and they sold them.
But whatever it is.
A passing ban, though, unfortunately, at that time, was about selling someone for their value.
Right, but all I'm saying is that the brothers didn't sell him, which is what...
That's what you mean, the bear.
Yeah.
Put him in
the pit. Put him in the pit,
yeah.
But that's different than
selling. Yeah, right. What did they facilitate, and did they know what they facilitated? These are all really good questions. Good questions. Now, I thought this was an interesting piece that Rav Kook really said. L'mashal, turn the page. הרי המציאות של עניים ועשירים, חלשים וגיברים, דבר מוכרח ונהוג הוא. For instance, the predicament of those who are wealthy and those who are less wealthy, and he's going to talk about the economic realities and different realities of the world, and then down to the English. The predicament of coal miners who as free laborers work and often still work under horrible and sometimes tragic conditions, talking about labor forces, were the mine owners to have an economic property interest in each individual worker, the owners would surely care for them better.
Sure.
Well, that's always said.
When slavery is regulated by Jewish law, when slavery is ודאי חלק האנשים שהם צריכים להיות שלפנינו ולולי הרשעה ששלטה כל כך בלבות בני אדם עד כדי רמיסת משפט הנה אם היו עבדים קוניים כעניין כסף אז היה מצבם יותר טוב. He says, the situation of those who would be enslaved would be much better if there was an economic interest. למשל עכשיו, for example, take now, אנחנו צריכים להראות מוסריות לדאוג עד חיי העובדים. We, in Jewish law, have to be very careful about the lives of slaves. Ha-chomri, the material lives of slaves, v'ha-musari, and their place in society and among us, in an ethical dimension. Only when slave owners are cruel does the institution become monstrous. Under such circumstances, it is better that there should be no slaves at all. The laws of slavery, according to Cook's take on this, and again, I said, they might be satisfying, they might not be satisfying. The laws of slavery are a noble, if not ideal, solution to a less than perfect economy. The ideal solution, presumably, would be merciful labor laws fulfilled by merciful people. It's at the core. Halacha, however, And I would say that he could be talking about past tense. Recognize that in reality, people will act in a way that is exploitative. And the Bible deals with this sad reality by prescribing slavery as one solution. As previously noted, however, in a world where people take cruel advantage, it is a better future, l'atid yoter tov, it's a better future to do away with the institution entirely. So I brought the source because people asked how it might have become part of the fabric of reality that slavery exists, or laws about slavery could persist in the face of an institution that could have been simply abolished. This is Rav Kook thinking very deeply about the institution of slavery. And I think important to consider the ideas, because we face the reality of the Talmud in front of us. And we face the reality of the debate about, what do we do? Are we freeing them? Are we not freeing them? Will we lose economic interest? Will we not? What will we gain by having this in the world? And what will be gained by a look into the future where it won't work? By the way, what is he saying? Az hayu bemet ha'ovdim hadalim alalu yoter me'usharim utzuim la'atid yoter tov. That we're going to create a situation where the world's workers are going to be so much better if we didn't have the institution. And what was his message?
The message is, here the people are coming back into the land. I think he wants to make sure we don't... the people didn't do what the Torah said.
That's right. And we really create a future where we do not engage in this practice in our nation. That somehow it might seem plausible to some to be returned to a situation where we could see ourselves as ba'alim again. We could see ourselves recovering some type of legitimate practice. There are people in Israel who would say the same. There are people around the world who engage in the practice. And we are being made more aware of these practices consistently. And sometimes it's difficult for us to actually face that truth and think about what we can do personally. But the more we're aware of it, the more that we've considered ideas, both in terms of our just this past century and the Hakamat HaMedina and the creation of the State of Israel and all that created in terms of potential to link back with some of these matters of legal justification and adjudication regarding status of people and the law and the realities we're seeing around this issue in the world today as it's being called for more attention by interfaith leadership in our country and around the world. The more we have to pay real attention. I said to you, and just to finish up, that I've been reading Kiddushin because it's in the Daf Yomi cycle now. It's daily Daf. Take a look at the next page. There are 24 major human body parts: fingers, hands, legs, ears, nose, male sexual organ, nipples. We learn that the loss of any of them, tane ale bechulam eved yotzei behem lecherut, loss of any of them. And we're in this section now where, you know, even if it's private and you don't even see it, you know, it's not like a blemish on the hand or a loss of a finger, something that one can observe publicly. Any of the blemishes on that person, any physical pain or cruel or injury, they go out to freedom. They gain their freedom, these slaves.
That's for both slaves, Dani and Ivri.
Yeah. We're talking. Well, we're.
Incentive to do that to yourself.
So you know, the question is, if there's incentive, we talk about the cause being the owner. We're talking about Eved Ivri. In the second Kiddushin, by the way, so it's
right.
True.
So this is so that there's no abuse to them?
Right. Okay. So we're talking about less and less abuse, and the question is whether or not you can transfer exactly the learning in Kiddushin all the way back to the Eved Kenani, and hold off, because sometimes you get the parallel going. And even Ezra says the following: Siva Hashem sheyatzah eved chofshi tachat eino o sheno. He goes free on account of his eye or tooth. What word did he use there? Eved. What word did the Gemara use? Eved. So regardless of the take on the halacha, whether or not it's Eved Ivri,
Okanani,
Hebrew or not, we just learned, and I'm going to leave it here tonight, and we'll start with one or two of these the next time, just so we come back to the major issue. Go back to Vayikra. What's the word for the non-Jewish slave? Eved. It's Eved. So in the dialectic, again, of the Gemara, whether you're, and I'm hedging because the system isn't entirely worked out, the word is the same. The message of the Gemara is pretty clear. You have to do everything in your power to lessen the physical abuse and damage. And if you look at the source just down below on that page, and I won't do the one on the very back, but I'll read you this at least. There's a book by Shmuel Rubinstein about the ancient origins of halacha, some of the early scientific work about the legal system of the Jewish people. For whatever reason, the master could blind his eyes. You see, it's bolded. That's because it says, the slave was an object in the hands of his master who could make him toil day and night and subject him to all kinds of degradation. He could hit him without mercy for any small thing, wound his flesh without any worry of punishment. For whatever reason, the master could blind his eyes. Herodotus tells us that the captive Scythians who made butter were all blinded.
But we have ancient Near East texts.
There were so many reasons that they blinded slaves, and gouged eyes were a symbol of slavery.
We have texts that go back even thousands of years earlier. They blind all slaves.
Right. Therefore, and this one at least is his research at the time of 1926.
Yes, absolutely.
Therefore, they would blind war captives. They would cut off hands, fingers. War captives had their thumbs and big toes cut off as a symbol of slavery. Cutting off the ears was so common that it was established as a typical punishment. They would castrate their slaves. They would cut the slaves' tongues, particularly if the slave knew some judicial testimony against the master. They would knock their teeth out so they wouldn't be able to eat much. Not us. The notion is that we had this principle in the Gemara working for us, and its application, I think, is the wider application and not the more narrow, despite some of the discussion that's going to go on about its narrow application. And that dialectic exists here and creates for us this high responsibility, high level of responsibility towards our slave physical welfare, and of course, back to Shabbat, the slave's spiritual welfare. Erev Tov.
Are we making some classes?
Jay, do I press?